Do you know how Adam characterizes that arm of our work?
How so? Please indulge me.
He says our strategy is after the redistricting, we sue until they're blue.
Right. It's like such a fascinating strategy to lead into, where you say, basically, we're going to do a bunch of stuff that's probably illegal. Then they're going to sue us for it because it's illegal. And then a judge will overturn it because it's illegal. And then we're going to be upset about that.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight.
How did the 2020 election affect Democratic prospects for the upcoming redistricting season? I was pleased to speak recently to John Bisignano, who knows a lot about this subject. John is the executive director at the National Democratic Redistricting Committee. The NDRC is a Democratic organization that is the strategic hub for a comprehensive redistricting strategy for our side. The NDRC, which is chaired by former Attorney General Eric Holder, has been working on leveling the playing field because things did not go well after the 2010 census. John is a Democratic political operative who has experience running other organizations in the progressive ecosystem, like the Association of Democratic State Chairs. So with that as background, a quick word from our sponsor, then my interview with John at the National Democratic Redistricting Committee.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from TimePlots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. TimePlots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
Hi, John. Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. Thanks for having me first. My name's John Bisignano. I am currently the executive director of the National Democratic Redistricting Committee and its affiliate groups. And we do a great deal of work on the redistricting process, which I'm excited to talk about today. Before that, I worked at the White House, at the Obama White House, for a period of time as the liaison for progressive groups, labor, and national security issues. I worked on the three presidential campaigns before this current one.
Yep. So you've been a political animal for quite a while.
Yes, I believe that's true. Despite still not feeling that way. But yeah, I think it's a fair assessment of my career at this point.
Why do you not feel that way?
I think I just still fancy myself an average person that's trying to figure out their way in the world of politics. I think politics is such an interesting place where, you know, you have so many folks that live in it and die in it. And then you have a bunch of people that just want to engage and help people. And I think I find myself in the latter camp.
Well, you've somehow become a professional in the space. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Milton, Massachusetts and Atkinson, New Hampshire. My dad lived in New Hampshire. My mom lived in Massachusetts. And I kind of went back and forth.
Were they political people?
They were not. And maybe that's why I feel the way I do. I think I certainly did not come from a family pedigree of political animals or politically engaged folks. I think both of them, you know, were generally aware and care a great deal, and certainly probably have become more political since I've engaged in this process the way I have. But I did not grow up in a world of politics. The first thing I ever personally did politically was volunteer on the Obama campaign in 2008. And I had really no concept of how to engage in campaigns. And growing up the way I did with outside of Boston, I don't think I ever had anybody knock on my door from a political perspective. I had zero concept that campaigns were even run, really. You know, I knew that presidents got elected and there were other elected officials that I was always interested in, but I never really understood that it was a way that you could support those folks and try and shape the process. until the 2008 campaign. And so someone told me it was possible, packed my bags, drove down to North Carolina and started volunteering during the primary. But growing up in outside of Boston, I really didn't have any perspective on what this was, that there was like a way to support them beyond, you know, walking into the polling booth and voting.
I know that you went to Providence College for both undergrad and MBA. What did you study there? And where was this volunteering for Obama with respect to your educational path?
When I started at Providence, I went in with the notion that I was very interested in politics. Again, didn't fully understand it, didn't understand what it meant. If I remember correctly, I declared my major as political science going in, which probably shows you where my head was. I think I survived maybe two political science classes, maybe three, before pulling out and switching to marketing and business, because frankly, when I was in those classes, the other folks in the classes gave me a perspective of politics that I did not enjoy.
What sort of things were they saying or doing that you didn't like?
It wasn't that I didn't like them. I think I just, truth be told, went into those classes thinking like politics is a really interesting way that you can help people, and then found a whole bunch of folks that were very interested in like personally running for office, and like they were going to be the president and it's going to be so important. And I was turned off by the whole thing and very quickly just shifted my focus away from it and thought, I clearly didn't understand what this was. And maybe I'll just go in a different direction. And there's a lot of different things out there. Now, focusing on marketing and business generally, I think has proven to be much more successful for me in the political realm, because it's not something, you know, everybody that engages in politics has a background in, and I've found it to be really helpful in being able to understand budgets and organizational structure. It's not a thing that every political animal, as you put it, has in their background. And when it comes down to it, a lot of these organizations that function in the political environment, which you above all understand, given that you founded one, it ends up being a business. And so just making sure you have the lights on and people are getting their paychecks on time and fed is a pretty critical part.
Were there things that you learned in that MBA program that you still are drawing on?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think the general premises of accounting and budgetary focus, understanding how a normal budget works or would look, understanding general managerial practices, although management I always found to be a bit, it's an art more than a science. And you can certainly learn from case studies, but so much of it ends up being interpersonal and human more than anything else. But certainly a lot of those hard skills that you just really never experience in the political realm until you sit down in a chair where you just took a job and they say, this is the budget. What would you change or what would you do? And you start asking questions that are a little bit different in focus. I took a lot away from it.
Yeah, I bet you did. And, you know, it is kind of rare to bring, a lot of people bring a law degree and that's helpful. But I've seen a lot of people who've really taken an MBA, apply it into the world of management in politics, and it takes them further. You know, it is pretty useful.
I did spend a lot of time, and I think this may be where we first met, with the Association of State Democratic Chairs, where I was the executive director for a period of time. And that may be the place where having a background in business in some capacity showed itself the most, in that so many of these folks that run for state party chair are incredible people that are impassioned and emboldened to take on a mantle within the Democratic Party, especially some folks in tough states where they decide, you know, I'm going to be the leader in the face of the party in my state, which is great. But those organizations are businesses. We had so many people that would come in as a new party chair and be like, all right, I'm going to spend all my money on this. And you're like, sir, what money? Or ma'am, you know, you need to raise that money. We need to figure out a plan for how we're going to be able to build up a infrastructure here. So I think that certainly showed itself there.
Well, tell me a little more about that time at the ASDC. I don't think everyone knows about what that's like. How did you land that job and what was it like?
I had a strong working relationship with the then president of the ASDC and also the current chair of New Hampshire Democratic Party, Ray Buckley. I actually interned with the ASDC in 2009 for a period of time immediately after the election. I think that was the first thing I did inside the DNC after the election before going, I transitioned to OFA once OFA got launched inside the DNC as a special project, which was where the Obama campaign assets transitioned to after the election in 2008. I had known Chairman Buckley, worked really well with him for a period of time, and then knew him more over the course of the next 4 years, and then spent a great deal of time in New Hampshire in 2012 election, where I went up. I was working in both Massachusetts and New Hampshire on a few different programs focused on the presidential, and then interviewed for the job shortly after that cycle ended, and was lucky enough to do it, which it's really a remarkable place. You're totally right that most folks don't know it exists or don't focus on it. And there are tremendous people that worked there that I did work with. There's a woman named Ann Fishman who has been there for a really long time and knows literally every in and out of the Democratic Party infrastructure, which is remarkable. And a woman named Geneva Jones, who I worked with as well, both of which just tremendous people to spend time with. But it also echoes what I said earlier in that you start to meet the association, I should say, is the organization inside the DNC that focuses on state parties. So it's the unifying presence within the Democratic National Committee of State Parties. I think most folks think of state parties as maybe like a branch of the DNC in a state, but really it's not. They're all functioning on their own. Each individual state party has their own bylaws. They make their own elections. They elect their own chairs. It's like they're all their own entity. And so the ASDC functions as a unifying force to allow for the state parties at large to speak with one voice on the national stage, which is great. It's super important to give those folks a voice. And as we did a great deal of training work while I was there, and you know, you do really get to meet all of these individual state party members and chair people that, again, decided to run out of nothing but the goodness of their heart, especially in some of these harder states. They're just wonderful people and they just need some guidance usually as to how to either navigate the national stage. Many of them may have been an activist in a state, but they don't necessarily understand the full landscape of the DC organizations. It's like, how do I engage with the DSEC, which handles Senate races? How do I engage with the DCCC? What type of relationship are we supposed to have? So just giving people that kind of guidance, I found to be the most interesting and helpful.
What surprised you the most about it?
The lack of a firm transition plan, I thought was always a little bit troubling. I think when you look at it from the outside and you think, oh, these are like just the branches of the DNC, some DNC person just appoints like the Massachusetts head, and that's the person that becomes the chair of that party. Whereas it's all ground up, which is great in the way it should be, but it does make it really difficult for a lot of these folks, I think, to like transition once they elect a new chair, and it's like having a new budget. It really depends. It depends so much on the person that decides they're going to run the party. Maybe, you know, they were elected to the position and don't really like the person that's incoming, and so they don't give them any resources on the way in. They don't tell them what the budget looks like. I feel like that's the part that is always difficult. Trying to keep some sustainability inside these parties should be the goal. And I think that was always the part I found most difficult.
Yeah, that makes sense. You mentioned that you were at the White House. That's what I think you did next. You said you were a liaison to progressive groups. That's sort of, in a lot of ways, the subject of this podcast. Who were you talking to? What did you learn there?
It's one of the most remarkable and wonderful places to work. I never expected, nor I'm sure again will feel, the ability to impact things on a level that you do when you're in that building. And the scope and scale of your day-to-day work is so astronomical that it's really difficult to even appreciate in the moment. But I think a lot of people talk about people that burn out at the White House and they get tired of it. I was never that person. I was a person that loved every single day I was there and was just awestruck by the ability to walk in that door and work with so many amazing people. Every meeting you walk into is just you're a collection of the smartest human beings in the world on that topic matter. And then you find yourself there and you're like, well, I don't know anything about this, but I can tell you how progressive groups would react in that role, especially within the progressive component of it. We were operating in such a different landscape than we are right now. The world of progressive groups coming out of the 2016 cycle obviously exploded. There are new podcasts, for example, that are exciting and being listened to. There's a whole host of new incredible groups, and it was just a more limited environment. I spent a lot of time with a lot of different labor unions. I spent a lot of time with, you know, Move On and a whole host of outside organizations, depending on the topic area. We used to organize an event weekly called Big Table that I inherited, I didn't create, but it was a really, to me, astronomical way to bring groups together around certain things. So one of the most complicated parts I found, and this is in the old progressive group landscape, so I'm sure it's only more complicated now for whomever is incoming into this role in the new administration, the difficulty in trying to get the progressive groups aligned around certain issue sets. So, and maybe some of the issue sets they don't always care about. So for example, one of the things I did a lot of work on was the Iran deal, which I guess was a merger of the national security component of my job and the progressive group component of my job, where a lot of the people that were supporting it were these progressive groups. But you didn't always have folks that would have known what that was or care about that. It feels very like a national security issue. If you're, let's say, SEIU or let's say the steel workers, you know, you're maybe just sitting on the sidelines. You're like, I don't know what that is. I'm not going to chime in on that. We're focused on other things. But we ran this thing called Big Table that I was referring to earlier, which was a large group weekly in which progressive groups would come to the table and just hear from an individual from the administration. We'd cycle through different people, different high-level administration officials that would, you know, talk about different issues of the day. It wasn't like only, you know, wage issues, or it wasn't only anything.
Was it telling them what's going on? Was there any listening to?
There was. It was both.
Yeah. Yeah.
For sure. There was a lot. It would basically start with a presentation, for lack of a better word. Usually it wasn't that formal. It would be a person just talking over where the administration stands on, let's say, minimum wage, just for example. But then, you know, people would ask questions. There'd be a clear dialogue, obviously the opportunity for disagreement in the room. But what I found mostly that it did was it broadened the scope of what everybody was able to understand. So in working on the Iran deal, you may well not have thought the steel workers would have a care in the world about it. However, found out through, you know, a whole bunch of different mechanisms that the president of the steel workers at the time, Leo Gerard, had spent a great deal of the beginning of his career in a yellow cake mine in Canada. And so he had a lot of insights on the deal and why it was important. And, you know, I think that is the type of thing that we never would have understood or known or captured if we didn't have people coordinating as well as we did.
Was the attitude towards the progressive groups one of, you know, from the White House side, was it one of these people are pushing us where we don't want to go, or these people are really our allies and we need them? Or how do you think kind of holistically the White House looked at this assembly?
I always found it to be very positive as a relationship between the groups at large and the White House. There were certainly moments of tension and individual moments, but it almost felt to me more like a family than anything else. It was like, sure, you can disagree with your brother about something, but like in the end, you know, we're going to be able to come to some kind of agreement or take the time we need to work through it, if that makes sense. It was that type of relationship. It definitely didn't feel like an adversarial relationship or that these groups were driving us somewhere that was crazy and we didn't think it was. And maybe that's because the conversation was fluid. You knew that every week you're going to be able to walk in those doors and you're going to be able to say what you needed to say. And so maybe that actually created a more constructive environment for everybody. Because even someone that has no, I'm talking about someone within the White House that would have no exposure to these groups or these people got that exposure, you know, maybe once every 2 months or 3 months, they'd stroll in, do their presentation on minimum wage, and then everyone would have a conversation about it. So I think it was really helpful to make everybody feel as though they were heard and be on the same page in some capacity. Now, I'm not saying we landed exactly where we needed to for every progressive group to be happy all the time, but that's what a family is.
Yeah. And then you went out and got on the New Hampshire coordinated for the Trump election in 2016, and Hillary narrowly carried that state. What was your lens on the campaign from that vantage point?
I will say I had a very difficult time leaving the White House personally, and I was totally comfortable to stay there through the end. I would have loved to. I felt a personal conflict and great deal of concern about Donald Trump himself. I'm not one of these people that claims to be some kind of clairvoyant that like, I knew Donald Trump was going to win. And so I like did what I could, but I did feel concerned. That's just a real fact. And if I remember correctly, I went fairly late for when they had been hiring coordinated directors. I wasn't like one of the early people that jumped on, but I really wanted to go with enough time to be able to build a program. And that was my personal biggest focus, because this year aside, given COVID and the way that folks could engage, I care a great deal about grassroots organizing and the way in which it's built. And that takes time. And it takes training great people to be able to do great things and communicate with folks on the ground. But that was my biggest focus when I landed there, was growth of the organization, the grassroots organization, and continued persuasion support. And I had a great deal of support from folks in state that also felt that way, which made it really, that part really easy. But I'll never forget getting a poll back. It was sometime in early October that had us up something like 14. There were these moments where we just felt like we were flying so high and it was going to be, we're going to dominate the election, which I know everybody felt in their own capacity. But keeping people focused and making sure that everyone understood that we were going to fight for every vote until the end. I felt very grateful that we took that tact when we did, because it was so close. Yeah, it was just a really difficult election for so many reasons. And obviously, there were so many countervailing forces that we dealt with and felt on the ground as soon as they happened. And it's really interesting way to see the world.
Where were you election night?
I was in Manchester. I spent all night for the most part in a boiler room trying to figure out what was happening and where. We figured out what was happening in New Hampshire and that it would be close, but that we would likely win fairly quickly considering the full scope of things. It's pretty difficult.
Yeah.
It's not a pleasant experience for anyone.
Now, that was a tough night. So you are now at the National Democratic Redistricting Committee, and you started as director of campaigns, and now you're executive director. We do a redistricting after each 10-year census, and the census has just been conducted. So this was the crucial election to get right in the state legislatures so that, and the governorships, I guess, so that we could be in as much power as possible for drawing the new congressional and state legislative lines. I was watching one of the Republican networks, and Adam Kincaid, your counterpart on the Republican side, was on, and he was quite exultant about how the Republicans had done. And what's your view?
I'll start by saying I have not seen that interview, so I can't react to his.
I found it annoying, but yeah,
I think that's probably fair. I imagine I would have too. I think the bottom line from my perspective is that you know, Democrats are in a much better position right now than we were in 2011. And that's been the goal of this organization the whole time. And the goal of the organization since President Obama and A.G. Holder created it, you know, with our President Kelly Ward in 2017, was to make sure that this organization was laser focused on redistricting the whole time. And within the Democratic Party infrastructure, we had a specific place that cared about this topic. It wasn't just a product that, you know, somewhat lived in different areas. I feel like we've been crystal clear on that and good about it. So as I look back at the election on Tuesday, my perspective, like I know that a lot of folks are writing stories that are concerned. From my perspective, nothing really changed in the election on Tuesday. Like, sure, we were hopeful that we would pick up the Texas State House, right? For example, we did not pick up the Texas State House. Now, for Republicans to go out and take a victory lap because we didn't flip one of the reddest chambers in this country's history over the course of the past 10 years, I see that as a success on our part. Like, we played this battlefield to a place for this last election cycle on Tuesday. We were playing on the absolute hardest turf that we possibly could. If you look at the landscaping map of redistricting, almost nothing changed from Monday to Wednesday, which I totally appreciate and understand the anxiety that we didn't win a bunch of stuff. Like, that's fair, right? If Republicans are going on TV and saying, look, they didn't dominate us like they thought they might, then that's fair. That's a fair assessment of the situation. I don't necessarily give credence to the fact that they won a bunch because they really didn't. The only chamber, the only place in the country that changed a lever of power on Tuesday was New Hampshire, which that again, that's fair. New Hampshire is now a Republican trifecta. That is true. That's two U.S. congressional seats. But realistically, when you look at the full map, almost nothing changed. So I would argue the biggest differences that were made in the redistricting process since this organization has been created were the elections in 2018 and then holding the line in the elections in 2020. Like, we didn't backtrack, you know, it's not like we suddenly lost a bunch of chambers that we didn't think we were going to hold.
John, what's the scope of what you guys do? So there's clearly the work on the campaign politics, the trying to be in the strongest position in the states. What other things do you guys do?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked and thank you for it, because I think it's the landscape of redistricting is so complicated, and it's not just the political landscape, right? That is certainly a part that we engage in, and the NDRC specifically as an organization engages in that component. But we, as I noted earlier, we have other affiliates. We have a grassroots advocacy organization termed All on the Line, which many folks have heard of. I think building out that grassroots army has been a core part of the way that we've engaged this process. That is something the Republicans have not, you know, given credence to. And so I think making sure via that army, and that is the product of a combining of forces with ourselves and OFA, the historical Obama organization, to create this organization of volunteers, grassroots volunteers, that are going to be able to focus on the redistricting process and keep it in the light, which is something that very, very clearly did not happen last time. In 2011, there were very few either public repercussions or even public awareness on when so many of these Republican legislators were drawing maps inside, you know, sometimes in Wisconsin, for example, in hotels directly across the street from the legislature, drawing maps in a basement and then bringing them over, not even showing their own members and passing them. Given that component, we have a lot of work to do and making sure that the public is much more aware and involved in the process than they were before. We also have a litigation arm that does a great deal of litigation work that will focus on a whole host of ways in which, from a legal perspective, what Republicans do is illegal. So historically, what they did in 2011 was termed illegal by a number of judges, right? So I can't say what they're going to do. They have never proven me to be great actors in this space yet, but who knows? I will leave that to them for the moment.
Do you know how Adam characterizes that arm of our work?
How so? Please indulge me.
He says our strategy is after the redistricting, we sue until they're blue.
Right. It's like such a fascinating strategy to lead into where you say, basically, we're going to do a bunch of stuff that's probably illegal. Then they're going to sue us for it because it's illegal. And then a judge will overturn it because it's illegal. And then we're going to be upset about that. Yes.
Well, I wanted to give you a chance to put it that way.
There are a lot of different ways that we're going to engage in this cycle. There are a lot of different paths for fair maps in a lot of different states. And I think one thing that above all else has become crystal clear over the past 4 years has been that each state is very, very independent. So the way in which they draw their maps, the laws that are on the books, the legal precedent in the state, the grassroots apparatus in the state, the political landscape of the state, all of those things go into understanding how each individual state operates. And so we do handle every state individually.
I did a little bit of work in 1990 cycle on redistricting. One of the things I learned about it then is it's very data and geographic information system driven. The ability to know, to have voter data, you know, election data, demographic data, to know where people are is very integral to drawing lines in the way if you're partisan to benefit your party the most. Is that something that NDRC gets involved with, or is that located elsewhere?
No, it is. I think that's the last branch, I would argue, if you're asking, as you're asking before, the different components of what we do. We are very focused on the tech side and making sure that as a party or progressive groups, however you want to term it, we have the ability for individuals to be able to understand the maps at a much greater depth than we did before. I think one of the interesting things that I, upon digging in, I don't know what, 2017, I guess, as we're starting to figure out the tech landscape that we understood, we were trying to figure out whether it was a tech problem, what was the issue that we had last time that we weren't able to see what Republicans could see, right? Because there are a number of times Republicans had tools and data that they would draw a map, they would show a Democrat, and a Democrat wouldn't really be able to tell what the Republicans knew from the data that they had, right? Maybe this district looks good for 2 years, but then gets terrible because we know that population's shifting in one way or the other. So we are fully committed to making sure that we have data assets available to folks to make sure that part is covered on the Democratic side in a much more robust way than it was last time.
So how do we do that? Who do you work with to make sure you have that information?
Yeah, I mean, we work with a lot of the big data firms. But realistically, what we found upon doing the review is it wasn't as much of a tech problem. The interesting thing is a tool that Republicans use well, a number of people use called Maptitude, which is pretty well publicized at this point. That's a tool that had been used for a number of cycles before. You may have, well, I don't remember when it started. I was going to say you may have
used it. I knew the guy, Howard Simkowitz, who used to run that part of it. Yep.
We were concerned going in that like, wow, this tool seems old. This has been used for a really long time. It seems crazy that we're using the same tool. Very clear that that tool is not the problem. I think we will still use that tool in some capacity moving forward. But the issue was the data underlying it, making sure that we work with as many data firms and places as possible to understand things like population shifts and the different partisan breakdowns of states or districts. The other part of it that I'll say, and this gets lost in translation a lot, you know, so much of this is really complicated, so it's difficult to unwrap. So I guess I appreciate an hour to dig through it. A fair map is ostensibly good for Democrats, not in a way that like it's a Democratic map, but like getting to a fair place all works for us. That's a process by which we've always believed, and A.G. Holder says this consistently, that if it's a fair playing field, Democrats are going to do just fine. Democrats are going to be in a place where we genuinely believe that we have the issues on our side. We have truth on our side. We're going to be able to compete in these places. So from my perspective, just getting to a place of fairness is the biggest goal. Republicans very clearly, and I don't know what Mr. Kincaid said?
I think he as much as said that they were in a position to lock in their advantages, meaning, you know, acknowledging that there were unfair maps biased to their advantage in certain states. I don't remember him enumerating them exactly. I think he did talk about some of them, and, you know, kind of feeling like they could keep it that way. When I talk to people in the progressive community lightly about this, I hear concern that, you know, certainly the maps in 2010 led to a disadvantage for us in the Congress and in a bunch of the states. It sounded like at the beginning of the interview, it sounded like you think we're going to come out better off than we did 10 years ago.
I do. Significantly better. Much better. And there are a lot of reasons for it. And this maybe dovetails into a lot of the different things that I said about the ways in which we engage the process, which has very clearly been the right strategy. It's, I think, a strategy Kelly Ward, our president, came up with. It's not a strategy I came up with, but it's very clearly been correct in that there's no one way to fix this problem. There are a number of folks that were hopeful that the Supreme Court at some point would take action and just like fix gerrymandering. Didn't happen.
Partisan gerrymandering, yeah.
Partisan gerrymandering, right. It didn't happen. So I think if we find ourselves in a place where having this approach of all of the above has very clearly been beneficial. But as you dig into the states, a lot of states have implemented, and we've supported a number of these independent commissions that are going to go out and have independent arbiters draw lines. There's way more states that have that than had it before. I'd say in 2011, Republicans had control over, I think it's 213 congressional seats. In which they had the uninhibited ability to gerrymander, which they did in most of them. That number is already down to 175. And I would argue it's probably really down lower than that, given some of the commissions that are out there. Like Ohio has a complicated commission process. It's not entirely an independent commission. You know, legislators have a bit of a role in it, but nonetheless, there's a process by which they have to go through to try and create fairer maps. In supporting a lot of these independent processes, I think we've been able to break up a lot of what Republicans did last time. And if you're breaking down the country geographically and you start to look at the Midwest, where I would argue the Republicans did their most egregious gerrymandering, probably historically the most egregious gerrymandering of all time. Right in the Midwest in 2011, like Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, and there were a lot of districts that were lost over the past 10 years in those states. And now in Michigan, you have an independent commission, thanks to a grassroots movement that was created post 2016 cycle. In Wisconsin, you have a governor that will retain the veto power over the maps if Republican legislators can't come to a reasonable map drawing process, which again, they've proven the inability to do, but who knows? Love to see it. And then in Ohio, as I noted earlier, you have a commission process, albeit not entirely independent, but you do have a different type of process than you had before, where Republicans just had no holds barred. And then you look at the West. The West also has a whole host of independent commissions, like Colorado has put one in place. Arizona has a really strong process. Once you start to peel off a lot of these states, which we've done over time, you start to see that Republicans no longer have that massive advantage that they once did. And maybe this is why the Tuesday night massive win phenomenon is drives me so crazy. Because like if you see like a baseball game, we have been slowly winning this game over time. You know, like we've hit a home run in every inning. And then in the ninth inning, nothing happened. No one hit a home run. And then they're like, they go into the press conference after the game. We won 8-0. And they're like, did you see how they didn't score in the ninth inning? Wasn't that incredible? And you're like, well, sort of. But, you know, you didn't do anything to actually claw your way back. You just kind of like didn't do anything at all.
So what's the NDRC like as a place to work? How big is it? What are the sort of people that work there? And what do you do?
Yeah, we have wonderful folks, full team of wonderful folks. We are organized in a way that focuses on all of those components that I listed out before, and then some. But we're right now, I think we're around 50 folks. We're growing a little bit, or we have been growing. We started very, very, very small, and been growing over time to basically reach the point where we feel like we can handle what we have coming to us, right? We know that this is the most important moment starting, you know, Wednesday after the election. We are in the most important moment for redistricting. And so we wanted to make sure that we had the capacity we needed. We do have some folks out in the states running state programs, which is really important for us. And I think we just have a wonderful team of folks that are extremely driven towards the main goal, which is creating a fair process in this country for a massive part of democratic small D infrastructure.
Is there a role for regular citizens in this? How can people get involved that are concerned?
The best question anyone ever has asked. I think we have massive roles, mostly through our All on the Line program. So you can go to allontheline.org. Everyone will kill me for getting that wrong if I did.
Let me try it. Allontheline.org. We're on a mission to end gerrymandering.
That's us. That's,
yes, you got it. It's got Eric Holder walking towards me.
Yeah, it's brand new video. And this is actually Eric in North Carolina. Look, he's being walked around by students.
He seems to be. He seems to be walking the same place over and over and over.
It's a bit on loop. But there's a campus in North Carolina, an HBCU, in which Republicans divided the campus down the middle, which is one of the most clear and absurd gerrymandering components, where they said, like, you know, we're not going to let this student body have their say. We're going to divide it right down the middle.
So what's funny is they usually want to pack groups like African Americans at HBCU. Why were they splitting that one?
I think it all depends on the size. If there's enough people, a population in a space, you know, in a city, for example, it makes sense to pack it. Sometimes it'll make sense for them to, usually they term it packing and cracking. This would be a perfect example of cracking, where you go in, you crack up what would be a good voting block for one of those two districts. And of course, this university should be represented the same way, right? Everyone on this university campus should have their voice heard in Congress. And they've created an environment where that's not possible.
So what do you do? What's your job exactly?
Man, what a question. I think I spend the majority of my day, I think, ping-ponging between a lot of these different priorities, the strategies that we laid out, and trying to make sure that we are as prepared as possible for any number of scenarios. And I think the way in which redistricting has played out over time has, if nothing else, shown us that anything is possible and everything is complicated. So I think we do so much planning for different types of scenarios as an organization, and trying to lead that effort among all the different departments and components we have is both a pleasure and a very complicated environment to operate in.
Are there good allies that you have in other groups that are interested in fair line drawing and fair elections? Who else is in this fight with you?
When you look at the progressive community landscape, I have found no one that has had any hesitation about joining the fight with us. Speaking as a person that, you know, worked at the White House with progressive groups on a number of difficult issues where you're trying to build coalitions and some groups don't want to be a part of it. And, you know, you're trying to like cobble together different groups that do. I have found carte blanche in the progressive community and the democratic space for us to be able to engage. So pretty much every labor union that we've spoken to is at the table and been massive stakeholders in this organization, as well as all of the new progressive groups, I think, have been really helpful. I think everybody sees, at least from what I've experienced so far, maybe some folks, for whatever reason, don't see the problem here.
It seems like there's been a bit of a revolution in understanding about the importance of redistricting, particularly after 2010.
I appreciate you saying that because I think we have strove to drive that narrative and make sure that, I mean, it's a massive part of what we're trying to do is lift up this very complicated, nuanced issue and make it, as Eric Holder says, sexy, which, you know, it's a hard thing to do, but I do very much feel that we've put ourselves in a place where the public at large is much more clear on what gerrymandering is and why it's bad, you know? And the next step is to make sure that the folks that do feel that way and want to engage, visit allontheline.org, get engaged with us, also figure out the way in their state that they can be most helpful.
Before redistricting takes place comes reapportionment, where they decide how many congressional seats, how many districts there are per state based on the census. What states are winners and losers?
It's wild that we haven't talked about the census yet because it's so critical to redistricting. And it's in a really strange moment right now where the Trump administration has gone to great lengths to try and disenfranchise communities of color, a lot of different hard to count communities that they have seemingly not gone the extra mile to actually get on the census books. I think there's a lot still to be said on the census and how that data gets manifested. I'm very grateful that President-elect Biden will soon be taking over and have I'm sure have better eyes on the census data and make sure that it's more clear and fair. Cause it's clear that the Trump administration was trying to not count people.
There was also the controversy about whether illegal immigrants would count. Did that get settled?
It's not got settled. And that remains. It's one of the big outstanding questions on the census. It's been litigated in court. I believe there's a hearing on November 30th. We also, via Covington, Eric Holder's law firm, in a pro bono basis, are working on a case that will likely get joined with one of those cases. In reality, I think we're in a place where, from my perspective, the Constitution is very clear that you count every individual. The reason it's very clear is because, you know, racist landowners wanted to make sure that their slaves were counted. And so now we're in a place where they don't want to count every individual because it doesn't benefit them under the same racial guidelines, which is absurd. But either way, I think that will get litigated at the Supreme Court level. I struggle to understand how the Supreme Court would read the Constitution any other way.
What is a question that I failed to ask that I should have? While you're thinking of that, let me ask you, like, for you personally, are you looking for the next thing after having gotten through this election? Are you going to stay with as the ED through the process? What's the plan?
If there's one thing I've learned in politics, it's that every day you are allowed to keep your job is a good day. I would like to see this process through and make sure that we have fair maps in as many places as we possibly can. But also, as a superstitious man, I'm never a man that will say, I know what's coming tomorrow.
Fair enough.
I've been clear that I want to make sure that as long as they'll have me, I'll be here to do my part and make sure this process gets complete.
What do you think is the biggest misconception that people who pay attention to politics have about redistricting?
Actually, that's a great question.
We'll use that as yours.
I'll take it. I think that people from the outside that don't necessarily understand the nuances of redistricting, of which there are many, so it's not unreasonable to not understand most of this, see it as a very binary process and cut and dry. They say things like Democrats and Republicans both do it. What I say to them, for the most part, is, and this is the part where it gets really nuanced, it's not as clear for Democrats to gerrymander the way Republicans do. Like, Republicans very clearly can put a circle around a city or a group of African Americans or a group of any minority group that they know isn't going to vote for them. They can cut those people out of their district or pack them into a different district and totally disenfranchise that voting block of people. Democrats have a much stranger plight in that we are a big tent party. It's not as easy to just draw a circle around some group of people. I think for us, we end up looking for a fair map, which ends up being the most reasonable. There have been instances, I'm not delusional, in the past where you've had Democrats do egregious gerrymanders. I think Maryland is one of those examples last cycle, but I also think a lot of folks that were involved in that owned that. As you look at it, if you're pointing fingers at folks, Maryland gained one seat. And there are some folks that say Democrats gerrymandered Illinois, which Republicans held those seats most of the time. So you can't really make that argument. So you're talking about one seat on the Democratic side. And then all the assessments you see come out of Brookings and a whole bunch of other organizations say that there's somewhere between 15 and 20 seats that Republicans took every year over the course of the past 10 years. It's a really astronomical difference. That line of thinking frustrates me. It's not just more complicated because I'm saying Democrats are nice and they would never do that, which I believe to be true. Most Democrats are fair maps people, but it's more complicated because of the geographies in the states.
Well, John, it's really been an honor to talk to you today and learn a little bit more about what you're up to. Is there anything else you want to say?
Likewise. No, I just want to thank you. I very much appreciate the opportunity to dig into the nitty gritty on gerrymandering anytime you want. And I appreciate you. It's really great to talk.
That was John Bisignano. He's at democraticredistricting.com. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.